The best trips don't just take you somewhere new. They change the way you see the world. On Wayfinder Life-Changing Travel, uncover the delights of every destination across city hideaways and crystal blue shores. Sponsored by Season 2 launch partner, Fiji Airways.
When it comes to a stopover, people don't recognize the value until they actually do it. So I wanted to see how stopping off in Fiji and doing my buffer there instead of going straight back to Sydney, how that shifted me into the mentality and got me ready for going back to real life. And, you know, the best cure for anxiety is feeling nurtured and calm and taken care of. And I think Fijian hospitality lends into that quite well. Fiji kind of wraps around you in a way that's warmer than everywhere else. I think it's because the culture grew up centered by community.
Listen to brand new episodes of Wayfinder Life-Changing Travel on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or Die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1-3 and 7-day passes. Watch The Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Today, the tsunami that helped make Britain an island.
Unlocking new secrets about an ancient Cranog older than Stonehenge.
And an update on the mission to reconstruct an Anglo-Saxon ship.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams, where later on you're going to hear about the role of a conservator, the person responsible for cleaning, stabilising and in some cases restoring some of the objects that archaeologists take out of the ground before they go into store or on display.
Now, there was some news this week about an archaeological discovery on an ancient artificial island in a loch on the Isle of Lewis. These islands are what are known as Cranogs, and they're what, Helen?
Well, they are pretty much exactly what you've just said. They are ancient artificial islands. They can be made of stone mainly, or they can be made of stone that's kind of laced with wooden structures, brushwood, anything that could be piled up to make an artificial island.
Well, new research carried out by archaeologists at the University of Southampton on a crannog in Loch Borgarsdale have discovered something amazing. Now, although it may look like the entire structure is made of stone, it was actually built on a wooden platform. Let's bring in Dr. Stephanie Blanksheen, who's an archaeologist from the University of Southampton, to explain a little more. Great to have you on, Stephanie. Explain what's going on here then.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's really interesting because, as Helen has explained with crannogs, they are typically what you see as a sort of stone mound, a stone island in a watery environment. But once we started digging down on this site, what we discovered is the bits of wood that we saw sticking out around the stone island actually form a quite substantial wooden platform that's completely underneath the island and embedded into the loch bed now. Through the work that we've done, we've shown that this platform is Neolithic, so almost 6,000 years old and thousands of years older than what we have long thought crannogs were dated to. As I always like to say, crannogs are like icebergs. So what you see on the surface is only a small part of what's taking place below water. So you have to actually dig down and see what is down there. The problem with this is they're in watery environments. So as soon as you start digging down, once you hit the water level, the water starts seeping in. So really, while excavating is great, and it's been done quite frequently in the past, certainly in the antiquarian period, it doesn't really give you the full picture. It gives you just a small glimpse. So we actually excavated underwater to begin with. So we had divers underwater, we had a terrestrial crew on the island, and we sort of excavated towards each other until we met up. So we were able to clear a much bigger area underwater because it's just easier to excavate. It was at that point that we then saw that this little bit of wood that we were after was extending and extending and extending. So we started towards the island. It was about 10 meters that this timber structure was spreading back. So at that point, we saw the wood was extending under the stone and also considerably further out from the island than we had imagined. So essentially, we realized we had this quite large timber structure underneath that we could not have imagined when we first started excavating.
And how did you date the timber? Was that carbon dating or dendrochronology?
Dendrochronology, unfortunately, doesn't work so well on this site, and probably a lot of them actually because of the types of wood that we're finding, which is birch and hazel. So yeah, it was mostly radiocarbon dating.
So take me through the timeline then of how this structure would have been built.
The islands are basically treeless in today's landscape. So to find a very substantial timber structure, the first question you have to ask is, where did this wood come from? Where were these trees? You only have pockets of woodland in the Isle of Lewis today. First question, obviously, is where is that wood coming from? So we've taken cores around the loch to try to understand the potential landscape cover, vegetation cover at that time. So we think there must have been quite substantial woodland, and that wood would have been used to create this structure. We think quite possibly the loch levels were a bit lower than they are today. So it's a site that you could have walked out to. The question is whether it was completely underwater. Was it sort of a marshy landscape or was it a dry mound? So we're not quite sure, but it seems that they had a sort of clay mound, either that they had put together themselves or they found this natural sort of mound in the loch. And then they brought in large timbers and laid the timbers across the site. And then it looks like on top of that, you have the smaller portions of the trees, so bigger branches. And then on top of that, you would have this very compact brushwood layer. So all the little twigs and branches that came from these trees. We're not exactly sure if they put like a stone capping on it or if they were actually just working, moving about on the organic surface. But it seems at that point, the island was fully formed. It's quite possible this would have been just a single event where a community came together, created this island, used it for a couple hundred years, and then for whatever reason, abandoned it.
But it's now a stone structure, isn't it? So how did it get to being that?
Essentially, what happened was about 2,000 years after it was abandoned, a Bronze Age community came in and reused the site. They took a lot of the stone. There may have been perhaps like a stone perimeter around the site when the Neolithic people built it to kind of keep the timber in place. Or they brought in that stone themselves and they did all of that work. But they then clearly put this stone capping on the site and kind of consolidated it is what it looks like. We have some burnt materials and things that have indicated that have given us the Bronze Age dates. But then again, another 1,000 years later, an Iron Age community came and used the site also. Again, each time it seems that the use changed, the island itself was modified a little bit or consolidated, maybe it was made higher. We know that often these crannogs slowly sink into the loch, so they have to be built up again. So yeah, you have these different phases of use through those couple thousand years, several thousand years actually.
So over these thousands and thousands of years, why were people living on crannogs? Was it the same reason in the Neolithic and in the Bronze Age and in the Iron Age, do you think?
We don't think so, no. The typical interpretation for the Iron Age sites is that they were dwellings. What you see is these massive stone towers that are built on the crannog, and they're typically considered the residence of the elite. In the Neolithic, firstly, the islands are quite small, and you have this organic island. It wouldn't have been something that you would have lived on. We think, and especially because what we're seeing with the Neolithic sites is hundreds and hundreds of sherds of pottery being deposited in the loch around the island. So for us, that suggests some sort of ritual practice. So it could be that these were neutral spaces for different communities to come together and to share a practice, maybe to give thanks for the abundance of the harvest that year. They deposit some of the food back into the loch. Or it could be quite simply, they come together, they have a massive party, they break a bunch of pottery, and then they just discard it all their rubbish into the loch. So we think that's quite a different use than what you would see in the Iron Age, certainly. And what it seems in the Bronze Age is that they may have been cremating people. So they were actually using the islands to inter the remains of the dead. There was burning activity, certainly, when they were coming in the Bronze Age. That's quite possible. And the Iron Age, for this specific site, we have no idea what they were doing because we only have one or two random Iron Age dates that just completely threw us off. Each time you do get a slightly different use, even if the legacy, the idea of the Cranog stays in the minds of people, how it's used and how it's treated through time, I think definitely changes over the periods.
They're so mysterious and wonderful. And the idea that in the Neolithic, you might have the same archaeological signature for the same kind of ritual, but you could reconstruct it either as a party or as a very solemn event. I love that idea that the one thing that we're not able to reconstruct is the fun level. And I hadn't really thought about that before. I'm going to have a bit of a cogitate about the archaeological signature of enjoying yourself.
Yeah, and that's what gets us so excited about the site as well, because they are really these little time capsules. And as a maritime archaeologist, we're so fortunate to be able to dive down on these sites, lift up some pottery that nobody has touched in nearly 6,000 years since it was last deposited into the locks. That's really incredible.
Oh, you got a lot of work to do by the sounds of it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I would say we've only just scratched the surface. We have found new sites just by looking. We've excavated a very small portion of one site, but I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done just to understand really what was happening with these sites.
This is so fascinating to hear about, Stephanie. I hope you'll come back and tell us more in future years when you've begun to scratch the surface a bit more deeply. It is truly such an interesting subject, the Cranogs and what they can tell us. So thank you very much for coming on and sharing your findings with us.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. And thanks for your enthusiasm. Often it feels like I'm the only one who gets really excited about these things. So it's really great to see that people are really interested in these sites. And I hope we can really get the word out because they are just absolutely extraordinary. And they tell a lot about what people were doing in our ancient past.
Now, a few months ago, you heard how part of the Staffordshire Hoard, the largest collection of Anglo-Saxon gold and silver metalwork ever discovered, was going back on display at Birmingham Museums.
Yes, and since its discovery by a metal detectorist in 2009, a huge amount of effort has gone into getting the thousands of objects in a state where they can be enjoyed by the public. A lot of that work is done by conservators. They work with all sorts of objects that pass through the museum, using specialist techniques to stabilise them, clean them, and sometimes repair or restore them to their former glory. Now, Martin's been along to one of the conservation labs at Birmingham Museums, where Jane Thompson-Webb, head of collection services, has been telling him a little bit more about what goes on there.
This is it then. This is the treasure behind the treasure.
Absolutely. Yes, this is one of our two conservation studios, and this is where all of the hoard conservation was carried out.
My beady eyes are going around this room. We've got a series of desks where there's, looks like some paint over there. I can see some paintings on stands. I can see some vases, some very ornate looking vases over there. That looks to be some sort of mosaic. And then we've got these, what are these big tubes here? These tubes that are extending down from the ceiling and on big arms. These are enormous things. What's this?
So they do look rather spectacularly like dinosaur necks. So this is our extraction system for solvents. So we use a lot of chemicals, things like acetone and methylated spirits, to do conservation. And rather than breathing in the fumes, we have these pipes that suck them out to the outside world to just add to the general air pollution in Birmingham.
Okay, but you're keeping you safe in here, which is good news. Let's talk about some of the things that you're working on at the moment. And I can see this amazing painting over in the corner. There's a painting of a man with an amazing bit of facial hair. What's going on over here?
So we're currently working on some collections that are going to go into our art galleries. So we're going to reopen some Pre-Raphaelite displays. My colleague Ben is doing some work on the frame. So it's got rather dirty and has been knocked over the years. So there's been some, he's doing some infill and a bit of touching in so that the gilt frame looks as good as it can.
What's the process then? When something arrives here that you're wanting to conserve, where do you start?
Well, the first thing we'll do is actually have a conversation with the person who wants to put it on display to understand what they want from it, how they want it to look, because there are occasions when you do want to retain the fact that it's damaged or dirty to show that it's had a life. Other times you want things to look amazing. So we have that discussion first of all. Then there will be an investigation, a condition check, to try and find out what's wrong with the object. Very, very briefly, a condition check is it broken? If yes, how? So we're looking for, are there cracks? Are there losses? Are there parts of the image that have gone? Is it unstable? Can it stand up under its own steam, as it were, so that we can see it clearly? Once we've done that initial assessment, we'll then have some sense about what work may need to happen. Very often, it's just cleaning. Conservators quite often are very highly skilled cleaning people. That's what we do a lot of, but often there will be more things to do. So we'll have to repair broken elements so that the object retains its structural integrity. That may also mean that we have to do a little bit of filling in if there's a gap. That's not glaringly obvious, because what very often happens when you go and look at a display, if there's damage, that's the first thing that you see. And we want you to take in the object as a whole rather than the bit that's wrong. So we'll try and tone that in so that it doesn't shout. And yes, we're just generally trying to allow the objects to tell their own story in the best way that they can.
You talked about being a cleaner, but a lot of the work here is about bringing these objects that have maybe been underground or lost for hundreds, thousands of years, bringing them to life and allowing them to be seen by other people. There must be an amazing sense of pride that you get when you look at an object that you've done some conservation work on and people are enjoying it.
Yes, that's absolutely true. It's a huge privilege to be able to get so up close and personal with the objects, and we're very aware that we get a view that our visitors don't, because generally we've put them behind glass in some form. Sometimes you can get a little bit lost in the process, because very often the conservation itself, you know, takes a long time, it's very repetitive and it can be a bit tedious. But that point when it goes in a case, and particularly when we start to see other people looking at them, you go, oh yeah, it's amazing, and I worked on that, that's remarkable.
That was amazing to listen to, and it reminded me that conservators have got to be a particular kind of person. Firstly, they need to be a scientist. They need to know all about chemistry and biology. They also need to be a really careful person and yet confident with those really difficult decisions they have to make. They've also got to be really good with their hands, and they've got to have this artistic sensibility. So they've got to be really, really well-rounded people.
I don't think I could handle the pressure, because you get one chance, don't you? This is the object, and if you don't do it right, you've ruined it forever.
Yeah, it's not a job for a worrier.
No. And I think I am. I think I am a worrier.
The best trips don't just take you somewhere new. They change the way you see the world. On Wayfinder Life-Changing Travel, uncover the delights of every destination across city hideaways and crystal blue shores. Sponsored by season 2 launch partner Fiji Airways.
When it comes to a stopover, people don't recognize the value until they actually do it. So I wanted to see how stopping off in Fiji and doing my buffer there instead of going straight back to Sydney, how that shifted me into the mentality and got me ready for going back to real life. And, you know, the best cure for anxiety is feeling nurtured and calm and taken care of. And I think Fijian hospitality lends into that quite well. Fiji kind of wraps around you in a way that's warmer than everywhere else. I think it's because the culture grew up centered by community.
Listen to brand new episodes of Wayfinder Life-Changing Travel on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Catch the NBA playoffs on Sling TV, the most flexible live TV streaming service, putting consumers in control to watch games their way with flexible subscriptions. Want to catch one game or a full series on ESPN? Grab a 1, 3, or 7-day pass. If you want to catch as many games as possible, get a monthly subscription with our ABC, NBC, and ESPN combo package. Either way, Sling lets you watch the playoffs your way with no long-term contracts. Learn more at sling.com.
This is the Time Team Podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Every year, Time Team gives its members the opportunity to, well, be with us in spirit, I guess, as we journey the length and breadth of the country on archaeological excavations. The Time Team Flag of Fame is back for 2026.
And this is such a nice way to show that you're supporting the work we do. So we have an enormous flag with hundreds of names that comes with us wherever we go, and it often finds itself being a backdrop to many of the scenes we film on site. And you can get your name or the name of someone special to you on the next one. If you're a Time Team member, so that's at Digger Crew tier and above, you can add your name to the official 2026 Time Team Flag of Fame.
Yeah, and you could add your name, or you might want to add somebody else's name. It might make a lovely present for someone, or even a fitting way to remember somebody. To be eligible, you need to make sure you're signed up at one of our paid membership tiers on Patreon before Sunday the 17th of May, and then you just click the link on our Patreon post. All names must be submitted by 1 minute to midnight, that is UK time, BST, on Sunday the 17th of May, when the offer will end. For full terms and conditions, look at the post on Patreon at patreon.com/timeteamofficial, and we can't wait to see your name on our Time Team Flag of Fame 2026.
Now, Martin, I think it's about time we got an update on the Sutton Hoo ship reconstruction. Now, this is the team of people working to create a replica of one of the Anglo-Saxon ships at Sutton Hoo, the one buried in Mound 1, using traditional techniques. And I was there just a few days ago, and I can tell you that work in the longshed is coming on fantastically.
That is very good news. And I think the last time we spoke to Jack Barnard, who's in charge of the project, was when she was inviting people to suggest names for the ship. But I know that a lot has happened since then. So let's bring her onto the podcast. Hello, Jack. We'll get onto those names in a moment. But first of all, I can see you there in the ship itself. How's it looking?
It's looking great, actually. I'm sitting right on the floor of the ship, which isn't a place you'd normally sit on in a ship because there'd be a floor. But we haven't got that far yet. But we are now doing the very top strakes, the top rows of planking, but not without a bit of disappointment this week, I have to say. The last couple of weeks, we had a lovely tree delivered, which we thought was going to be perfect for this part of the ship. And unfortunately, we found out yesterday that it is just not going to work. It didn't cleave as we anticipated. Imagine sort of like a, rather than a straight line going through a tree, it started to corkscrew. We managed to deflect that and retrain the split. But unfortunately, the wood is still twisted. You know, we just can't get the sort of sizes and shapes of timber out of this particular tree. So we're back on the search to get us back on track, really, so that we can get this boat finished and on the water next year.
Yes, well, a lot of people ask, why do we use these traditional techniques when they're so risky in a way? Why don't we just saw the planks and then we wouldn't have any of this problem? Why are we doing it so realistically?
We could saw the planks, but the strength of the planks would be very different to the original ship. And the whole point of this exercise is to replicate a ship that was made before, to put it through its paces, to see what it was capable of. So if we did it differently, we would never actually really know. So the whole project really would be fairly pointless. So to sort of explain, when you know, when you go to B&Q and you buy a plank of wood, the tree has literally been put through a sawmill, so you get a slice of it, like a slice of cake. What we're doing is we're cutting ours up like pizzas. We get wedges out of our trees so that the grain of the wood actually goes in the right direction to allow us to make much stronger planking in the way that they would have done then. So I'm afraid we've stuck to our authenticity from the beginning, and we're going to see it through to the end.
I was talking the other week about the launch of the ship, which is obviously the main thing you're working towards and a really, really exciting moment. And this question came in from one of our Time Team members. This is from Fiona, who says, for the launch of the Sutton Hoo ship, do we know from any sources like Anglo-Saxon poetry or chronicles what people back in the day would have done when their ships were first launched, and whether we can kind of recreate that?
No, we can only guess, really, because there wouldn't be any of those materials left. So, you know, potentially we could take the ship out on rollers, which is part of the theory of how it was taken up to the burial site, because, you know, they just didn't have the same mechanical things that we have nowadays. You know, in history, you could look at pictures, can't you? But there isn't a great deal out there. So we're trying to work out how to do it as authentically as we can, which will probably involve the use of heavy horses to actually manoeuvre the ship out of the shed. That's not something the Anglo-Saxons would have said, would they, manoeuvre a ship out of a shed? Because they wouldn't have had a shed. They've been building it on the bank. But we will then have to, because of modern health and safety, we've got to come up with a plan that is safe. We've got to keep everybody safe. The Anglo-Saxons probably would have used rollers and manpower just to push it into the water. But unfortunately, in 2026 or 2027, we're not allowed to kind of use people in quite the same way. So we're looking at different solutions to have a look and feel of it being authentic, but in a very safe, you know, 20th century way.
And I don't think, actually, that we've got any idea from history. I don't think even from poetry have we got any idea about how ships were launched. And it may be that the launching of the ship wasn't quite such a big moment in the life of a ship as it is today. And I don't think we've got any inkling of whether there was anything like a bottle of champagne being broken over, you know, like a pot of mead being broken over the one end.
We don't even really have an awful lot of evidence that they named their vessels. So although we are going to name it, we don't know that they did. And the same conversation came up last week about the ornamentation of it. There was no evidence of the wood remaining, so we don't know whether it was beautifully decorated on the outside. So we're going to take the artistic license of actually carving parts of the ship. Because the treasures inside it were so beautiful and so covered in ornamentation, it just seems logic to do that.
Let's talk about names then, shall we? Because you just mentioned them. Last time you were on, you were asking people for their suggestions. How many did you get?
Oh, boy. Yeah, we didn't anticipate this number, but we had over 3,800 names suggested. So we've got a great volunteer who's a data analyst, you know, in her past career. So she's been working on all of these names to try and put them into compartments or pools of things about a theme. So, you know, there's lots of themes about sort of Basil and Edith. There's lots of themes around sorts of Anglo-Saxon themes. There's obviously people have thrown in a few Viking names for some reason. People have suggested the name of their dog. You know, some of them are actually quite humorous. But we are, you know, the name of our ship needs to be thoughtful and meaningful and appropriate for something as beautiful as this. So we are having to wheedle lots of those out. I mean, I can share a few with you if you
oh yeah,
like.
Go on. Do.
These are some of the funny ones. I actually asked Jan, who's working on this, to pull these out for me. So her favourite was Chippy Chippy Bang Bang. We've had HMS Splishy Splashy.
Yeah, nice.
Sax on the Beach. That came up quite a few
yeah,
times.
Very good, yeah.
Boring McNo Fun, because we said no Boaty McBoatface. But we have had somebody submit Boaty McBoatface in Anglo-Saxon. Tried to slip that one in there.
There are lots
and lots of, and you know, lots of call it Fido, because that's my dog's name, or my grandchild is called Philip or whatever, but we're, you know, obviously we're having to wheedle those out. I think we're down to about 600 now, and we've got people that understand the Anglo-Saxon language sort of verifying some of those names, because we didn't just ask for a name without an explanation, so we're just checking out whether these explanations are accurate. And then we'll be putting our panel together with a sort of a long list, who will come down to a short list, and then we will ask a few people to perhaps campaign for maybe three or four that we'd be happy for the ship to be named, and would allow the public to vote on those final three or four names.
So what comes next, Jack? What's the next thing to do?
So immediately once the shear strake is finished, that's when the carving will start. At the same time, they will be completing all of the frames inside the ship. So lots of them are done. So most of the frames in the ship are three parts of timber. So most of the bottom frames, the floors are in, but the futtocks, the bits that go up the side, there's still quite a number of those to be made. Alongside all the oars are being made. I think we've made about a dozen, but you know, we need well over 40. The floor will then go in, but at the same time as all of this, we are planning the launch. There's been a team of people looking at the possibilities for several months now, and it's not without its complications, both in terms of getting a ship this size on the water in a very confined area, but also about entertaining people in a safe way. So we're having to do all sorts of, you know, really boring things like going to safety advisory group meetings, and but more interestingly, meeting with our stakeholders to see, you know, exactly how they would like to perhaps join in and help with this event, because, you know, it will be the event of the year.
That sounds like it's going to be really brilliant.
It really does, doesn't it? I cannot wait.
I think I can wait, actually. I think I might plan a sort of short holiday that week.
You better not.
We can't live without you, Jack.
It will be great. You know, everything else, we've managed to work our way through, come to plans and put, you know, execute those plans pretty exactingly, really. So I'm confident that our volunteers have got what it takes to get this ship on the water.
Well, thank you very much, Jack, for updating us. It's been great to see you, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you very much.
Moving on now, and there's another classic episode of Time Team being published to YouTube on Sunday. It's a Time Team special. It's called Britain's Stone Age Tsunami, and it was first aired back in 2013.
Yeah, now I wasn't in that one, but I do remember watching it, and the programme looks at a huge tsunami that hit the east coast of Scotland over 8,000 years ago. It was caused by a 290-kilometre-long underwater landslide off Norway, known as the Storegga Slide. It was one of the things that contributed to the flooding of Doggerland between modern-day England and continental Europe, and maybe it was the event that finally turned Britain into an island.
Now, since 2013, there's been loads more research carried out into the Storegga Slide. And one of the people involved in that is James Walker from the University of Bradford. Great to have you on the podcast, James.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Now, you weren't in that 2013 programme either, but I know that you work with a lot of people who were. So was it quite fun watching them as they were sort of 13 years ago?
Yeah, it was really fun, actually. I was quite shocked to see, you know, a lot of work's happened since then, but I was really impressed with the programme, actually. I learned stuff looking at it. So, yeah, it was really, really fascinating.
Well, that's great. So tell us a bit more about it. How did this landslide come about that triggered the tsunami?
The origins of the slide itself are the subject of considerable debate. And I don't think there's actually a single smoking gun thing that we can point to and say it's definitely that without someone getting upset and saying, oh, I don't think so. What we do know about it is that it happened during the early Holocene, when the landscapes of Northwest Europe were still very much adjusting after the last ice age. The Storegga Slide happened around about the same time as a major episode of climate change in the early Holocene that climate scientists refer to as the 8.2 event. And they call it that because it happened around 8.2 thousand years ago. I don't know if there's a causal relationship between these things, but it's certainly interesting that they seem to happen at broadly the same time period.
And we're saying tsunami. Sounds very, very dramatic. How big of an event would this have been then, sort of 8,000 or so years ago, to the people who were living in that part of Britain?
Big. I think that's the one thing we can all agree on. Unprecedentedly big for this part of the world, that's for sure. There are reports of the waves having run up of, you know, maybe 30 meters or more in places. So particularly in some parts of the Norwegian coast, it would have been particularly bad.
30 meters tall?
Sort of. One of the interesting things about tsunamis is we often picture them as these big crested waves coming in, a bit like the sort of Guinness adverts, surfs up, that kind of thing. But the run-up of the wave really means that it reaches 30 meters high. It doesn't necessarily mean that the wave itself is 30 meters high, if that makes sense. So that's one of the things that some scientists have really been trying to grapple with in recent years is, well, what did the tsunami actually really look like? Was it a wall of water, or was it an unstoppable long wave that just kept on going and going and going?
And when you say reports, do you mean that people have found kind of sediments all this way inland? I mean, obviously, these aren't reports that, you know, it sounds when you say reports that you've talked to somebody. But as this is 8,000 years ago, probably not.
Yes. No, I'm not going to tell everyone about my time machine. That's quite right. These are geological deposits that we can tell come from the tsunami. They look like the sorts of sediment formations that we associate with tsunamis, and they fit the right date. And the main places where we've gotten evidence of this wave from have been in Scotland and the northeast of England, and also, of course, on the western coast of Norway. And the geology of these areas are quite different, and that means that the types of evidence we see are quite different, but it's geological evidences of the tsunami, and we can tell from these landscapes that it's reaching very far up the shoreline.
We had your colleague, Vince Gaffney, who actually did appear in the 2013 programme. We had him on this podcast about, it was over a year ago now, but he does a lot of research into Doggerland, this area that used to exist between England and what is now continental Europe, and slowly over time submerged, making Britain into an island. How did this tsunami contribute to Doggerland becoming submerged? Because in my mind, a tsunami is it arrives, but then it goes again.
Yes. A lot of stories talk about the idea that the Strega tsunami is what made Britain an island. And I think there's a very powerful narrative pull there, because it's sort of like, is that the birth of Britain as an island? And I hate to burst the bubble, but no, it actually wasn't. That doesn't mean that it was a very, very bad day to be at the beach for Mesolithic people. It absolutely was. But Britain was almost certainly already an island, or in the process, at the very least, of becoming an island. And what we realized, and we could actually see this in the sediment core that we'd found evidence of the tsunami in, is that tsunamis come, but they also go, right? You know, the waters get up really high and then they go back down again. So while the tsunami certainly would have impacted a lot of coastlines, including around the coasts of Britain, while it may well have killed a lot of people and caused a lot of devastation and loss, it wouldn't have been the thing that actually flooded Doggerland permanently or separated Britain from the rest of Europe. In fact, recent evidence seems to suggest that most of Doggerland was already underwater by this time. There still would have been large bits of the coastline beyond what we see today, but much of it may have already been, if not drowned, then drowning by the time that the tsunami happened. It's actually that climate change episode I mentioned earlier that perhaps has the biggest role to play in causing the sea levels of the North Sea to rise and parts of Doggerland to become inundated and people having to contract their territorial ranges and so on, that would have led to a greater isolation of the British Isles, I suppose.
You are looking, when you look at the tsunami evidence, you are looking at a single day, aren't you? And you can't ever normally see that in the past. We look at these long duration events, and to be able to see something that's so sudden, so brief, is extraordinary. You've been working on this for quite a few years now. What do we know now that we didn't know back in 2013 when the programme was originally broadcast?
We've found a lot more evidence of where we think the tsunami might have hit. And, you know, in terms of Doggerland, as I say, the big thing for us was finding evidence of it in the sea, because most of the examples of the Strega tsunami that we found have come from on land. And so this was the first time we'd found it at sea. And of course, importantly for us, it was not just at sea, but in a landscape that was active at the time and is since become submerged and so on. So it was sort of like a really tantalizing insight into how the people of Doggerland, or what was left of Doggerland at that time, may have experienced. I mean, some of the other stuff that's come out has included people being able to work out what time of day the tsunami might have struck at, which
really
is quite incredible on the idea of your moment in time.
What time of day would it have been?
Around tea time, we think. No, it's research done by scientists in Scotland in the Montrose Basin. They're using a technique, OSL dating, which tells you about the exposure of particular sediments to sunlight and things. And they were looking at tsunami deposits from the Montrose Basin, and they were able to work out that they think that this indicates the tsunami hit during daylight hours when it struck this particular area.
And that's amazing you can work that out.
We know what time of year it hit as well, and that's very important for understanding, or at least thinking about, how it might have impacted Mesolithic people. So we know that it appears to have hit sometime in late autumn, perhaps around late October, early November kind of time. There's multiple things that tell us what time of year, perhaps even what time of day it happened. And that's very exciting, as you say, because we often struggle to think about these sort of like precise moments in time.
It does make it much more real, doesn't it? If you know what time and what time of year, you can get yourself back into the thoughts of what it must have been like in a way that we normally can't.
Yes, some of the archaeological work that's happened in that time has focused on trying to understand how the tsunami impacted people at a population level using paleodemographic approaches. And various studies have suggested that at least in the British Isles, there might have been a population dip around this time. Perhaps that's to do with the tsunami. Perhaps it's to do with other things as well. And the work I was doing with colleagues in Norway was very much focused on how do you engage with the archaeology of an event like this, and what can we actually say archaeologically about the people that are impacted in this moment? Because we know about Mesolithic people and we know about tsunamis, but what we struggle to talk about is the people that were there at ground zero on the day that it actually happened.
Could I just ask something that's just popped into my head, James? Could it happen again?
I was wondering that.
Depends who you talk to. The current consensus, as far as I'm aware, is that it shouldn't happen again anytime soon, hopefully.
Oh. I don't think that's a good enough answer, actually. That's not put my mind at rest at all.
Yeah, it's happened before more than once. You know, we talk about this big one that happened in the Mesolithic period, but we know there have been certainly other submarine landslides in the same area, and it would be not a great leap to imagine that they may have also caused big waves. So take some armbands if you go to the beach.
But you can't live your life always being nervous of a tsunami, can you? Even if you do live somewhere like Newcastle or Edinburgh.
I don't know. I reckon I could give it a good go.
Yeah, it's always good to know where the nearest hill is, I think.
Yes, it is. And get good at running up it. Well, James, on that cheery note, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
If you're interested in learning more, our Time Team Classic special, Britain's Stone Age Tsunami, will be published on our YouTube channel on Sunday.
And that's about it from us this week. Thank you to our Time Team members, many of whom have been submitting questions ahead of our episode next week, where Helen is going to be answering some of them. And I think we've got a question, Helen, which could be our next Roman Stairs question. Long-time listeners of the podcast will know what I mean by that.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that. Now, if you're a Time Team member, there's the opportunity to ask a question for a future episode by visiting the chat section at patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll speak to you next week. Bye for now.
Bye.
Best trips don't just take you somewhere new. They change the way you see the world. On Wayfinder Life-Changing Travel, uncover the delights of every destination across city hideaways and crystal blue shores. Sponsored by Season 2 launch partner, Fiji Airways.
When it comes to a stopover, people don't recognize the value until they actually do it. So I wanted to see how stopping off in Fiji and doing my buffer there instead of going straight back to Sydney, how that shifted me into the mentality and got me ready for going back to real life. And, you know, the best cure for anxiety is feeling nurtured and calm and taken care of. And I think Fijian hospitality lends into that quite well. Fiji kind of wraps around you in a way that's warmer than everywhere else. I think it's because the culture grew up centered by community.
Listen to brand new episodes of Wayfinder Life-Changing Travel on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.